promised, we are joined right now by a New York Times bestselling author. His books include The Bad Guys Won, Love Me, Hate Me, Boys Will Be Boys, Showtime, Gunslinger. He was a panelist on the Daily TV show back in the day. He is a good friend of the program, and he's got a new book. It's called Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. The book comes out tomorrow. I want to make sure we got him on before the book actually dropped. He is Jeff Perlman. Jeff, what's going on? How are you?
And you forgot to mention he eats at Javier's. Because of Jim Rome.
And he eats at Javier's because of Jim Rome. All right, I'll take that too. All right, Jeff, so the book is an amazing book. There's so many different details and stories in the book that it's tough to know where to start, and I want to pick my spots. The first spot, though, is in the prologue. Before we even get into the first chapter, there's a story involving Samaki Walker, Kobe Bryant, and a $100 debt. What happened?
All right, so they were in Cleveland in 2002, and Lakers they would do these shoot-arounds where they would have everyone could get half-court shots, and the first guy to make the shot gets $100 from everyone. And on this day, Kobe Bryant makes a shot, and everyone has to pay him $100. So everyone's paying him $100, and he goes up to Samaki Walker, you know, journeyman forward, and says, "Maki, where's my $100?" He's like, "I don't have it. I'll get it to you later. But you better get it to me later." Later comes Samaki, "Where's my $100? I don't have it. I'll get it to you later. You better get it to me later." They're on the bus in Cleveland. And Kobe Bryant walks up to him and says, "Samaki, where's my $100? Samaki Walker says, "I told you I'll get it to you when I get it to you." So Kobe Bryant pulls back his hand and punches Samaki Walker in the face. Samaki Walker's sitting next to Jelani McCoy, and he goes, did this guy just punch me in the face? He's like, "Yes, he did." Shaq goes, "Yo, you better mess that guy up." And Samaki Walker first throws his Discman to 2002. Misses, thing shatters. The bus is moving. He yells at Phil Jackson. He's like, "Phil, stop the bus. Stop the bus." Phil Jackson, you know, man of the people, has the guy stop the bus. Samaki Walker challenges Kobe, "Get off the bus." Kobe refuses. "You won't get off the bus." And Samaki Walker said, "Yeah, I thought so, you know, blank in the blank." They get to the team hotel in Cleveland. And Samaki Walker, there's a message waiting for him. And it's a sobbing Kobe Bryant, an apologetic sobbing, "Yo, Maki, I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me. You know you're my guy. I'm so sorry." And later, when they were at the arena, Shaq used to have a bodyguard, Uncle Jerome. And Uncle Jerome comes up to Samaki Walker and says, "Yo, Samaki, there's this kid outside wants to talk to you." And Kobe Bryant comes in, and he's just apologizing. And Samaki Walker's like, "Listen, man, you can't do that to people. You can't be this way." And he just uses a really good example Samaki Walker did when I met with him about a guy who just was kind of lost and trying to feel himself out and never really was that comfortable around others.
Jeff Perlman is joining us. This book is called Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. That is a wild story. Before the Kobe Shaq era started, you had the Cedric Ceballos era. Now, it's easy to forget now, but what happened was said when Magic Johnson came back in 1996. How did the man who had nicknamed himself the Chise, as in franchise, take that, Jeff?
He did not take it well. I love that you're asking about Cedric Ceballos. So he, he thinks he's the man. He literally gives himself the nickname Chise, which led about five different Lakers to say to me, "What kind of fool nicknames himself after the franchise, especially when you're on the Lakers?" So, Magic has this comeback. It was a huge deal at the time. And Chise at first was pretty happy about it. Then his minutes are getting reduced because Magic is now a small forward. And he goes AWOL. He actually just leaves. He vanishes the team to go jet skiing. And the first person to find him, it's funny, everyone went on this like search, where the hell is Cedric Ceballos? And the guy who owns the jet ski company, someone somehow found out that Chise might have been there. And the first guy to identify where Cedric Ceballos was when he went AWOL was the owner of the jet skis company, who's like, "Yeah, he's out on there. He's out on the lake right now having a great time." And the Lakers are like getting ready to play Seattle. And that whole comeback for Magic, it was really kind of a disaster because he was an 80s guy with Chise and with Nick Van Exel and with Eddie Jones. And it just never felt right. And it did kind of lead to the beginning of the Shaq-Kobe era in a lot of ways because it was such a disaster.
Jeff Perlman joining us. Jeff, that's why he was nicknamed either, I don't remember exactly where it came from, but on this show he became known as Club Zed after they found him on the jet skis. He was forever known as Club Said. You know, Jeff, I've told the story myself, but back in the day when I had a TV show on Fox Sports Net, The Last Word, he came on, Club Said, as part of a panel. And this was back when the guys had their two-way pagers. There weren't like cell phones. There weren't Blackberries. There weren't even Apple iPhones. And this guy literally live in the middle of a segment, Jeff, was looking at his two-way pager. And we're having a conversation. You know, you've done these panels with me. I'm like, Said, what are you doing, man? Are you really literally on a live show checking your messages in the middle of a segment? He's like, yeah, what? Yeah, what? It doesn't seem so weird now, but believe me, in the mid-90s, that was really weird. Really
weird. Still
weird.
Still weird.
All right, still weird. Good. So you mentioned, like, Kobe and Shaq. In hindsight, going after Kobe Bryant seemed like the biggest no-brainer ever for Jerry West. But when Kobe announced he was going straight from high school to the NBA, what did scouts think of Kobe? And then what did West think when he saw him in those now famous workouts?
Well, it was a mixed bag. There were guys, you have to remember, this was a year after Kevin Garnett came out. And Garnett, everyone was like, well, you know, he's big. He's 6'11", and he has a huge wingspan, and he'll need time, but it can happen. And the idea was only a big man can really come straight from high school. So scouts were mixed. There were some scouts. Pete Babcock, the Hawks general manager, went and saw him and immediately thought, this guy's Scottie Pippen. He's that good. Other guys, though, complete opposite. This guy can't. He doesn't have the skills to play in the NBA. And it's funny, the Nets loved him, and the Nets worked him out 5 different times, loved him. Jerry West worked him out twice, loved him. In the lead-up to the 96 draft, the Nets were ready to take him. It was John Calipari was the coach of the Nets. John Nash was the general manager. They were done. They were taking Kobe Bryant. They called his parents and said, we are taking your son. How does that sound? Great, great, great. Calipari's young. He has final personnel say over who the Nets take. And he gets a call from Kobe Bryant, who says, yeah, I don't really want to play for you guys. I want to be far away from my family. I don't want to play for you guys. Then he gets a call from Kobe's agent. He says, yeah, Kobe really doesn't want to play for you guys. He'll probably sign with a team in Italy for a year and re-enter the draft if you guys take him. Calipari is just in his 30s. He's never done this before. He's new to the NBA. He goes into John Nash's office, and he's like, I don't know what we're supposed to do here. I don't know what to do. And Nash is like, listen, man, calm down. It's all a bluff. He knows that Jerry West behind the scenes is kind of working this to get Kobe to L.A. Then Cal gets a call from David Falk, Kerry Kittles' agent. And David Falk says to him, Kerry really wants to play with the Nets. If you bypass him, if he's there, none of my guys will ever sign with you. And Cal freaks out. And he goes back to John Nash, and he's like, we can't do this. We can't. And Nash is like, calm down. It's all bluff. This is how it works. So now it's the day of the draft. And Calipari gets everyone together. And again, he has final personnel say in his contract. A huge mistake. And he says, if Kerry Kittles is there at number 8, we're taking Kerry Kittles. And if he's not there, we'll take Kobe Bryant. Number 8 comes. Kerry Kittles is on the board. The Nets take Kerry Kittles. Jerry West is in L.A. doing a freaking jig. He has this whole thing arranged where Charlotte, he knows Kobe's not going to get picked in the next 4 spots. He goes to Charlotte. They make the Vlade trade. And Jerry West tells Jerry Buss right then and there, I just got you the best player in this draft.
Jeff Perlman joining us. That's an amazing backstory. Now, when you're talking about Kobe, Jeff, the thing that has always struck me is so unique and borderline bizarre was his incredible drive, his amazing hunger. We're talking about a kid from the suburbs. How do you explain this ferocity and fierce hunger and drive, which really bordered on psychotic?
It's a really fascinating sort of thing that I think some people to a certain degree are born with.
Not me, ever.
Yeah. No, not me either. I mean, his background is quirky and weird and confusing in that he spends a lot of his youth in Italy. He's one of the very few black kids around. There are a lot of cultural conflicts. He definitely gets some people making fun of him. He's a fish out of water. Then he moves to the suburbs. People say he's from Philly. He's not from Philly. He's from Lower Merion, which is really suburban and leafy and, you know, fancy cars and manicured trees. And again, kind of a fish out of water. And it was always a fight to prove himself, to show that he belonged, show that he was tough, to show that he could take it. He goes to the ABCD camp, you know, run by Sonny Vaccaro. And his first year there, he's terrible. And at the end of the camp, he actually apologizes to Sonny Vaccaro and says, if you have me back next year, I will not let you down. I promise. And he comes back the next year and wins the MVP. And he was a kid in high school. I mean, he would do crazy, crazy stuff. Like, he used to work out in the summer. He would work out outdoors at a track. He would have a car running. He would get in the car to take him to the gym where he was going to work out next and make sure the car's heat was blasting with all the windows closed. And he would make the 20-minute drive in a car with the heat blasting, having just worked out in 90 degrees, to make sure his temperature wasn't low and that he could endure as much torture as possible. It was just something in this guy that was abnormally fierce.
We are talking to Jeff Perlman. His latest book is called Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, and Phil, The Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty. The book comes out tomorrow. So, Jeff, what about Shaq? There was Shaq, and Shaq started his career in Orlando. What did he make of Orlando as a city and a place to live? What was that fit like?
I mean, I think he had a really nice mansion, and he had a good, you know, he had a good lifestyle there. The main thing was, so his agent, Leonard Amato, from the time he signed Shaq out of LSU, was all about, we need to get you to L.A., we need to get you to L.A., we need to get you to L.A. And if you remember, when he was in Orlando, he did probably one of your favorite movies of all time, Kazam. And the idea...
If not my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, I thought it was. I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying not one of, but probably my single favorite movie of all time. That good.
You know, it's the Shawshank of Shaq movies.
That's
and,
it.
You know, the whole goal was to become this thing. Like, that was what his agent was pushing for, this thing, this icon, this brand. Copy the Jordan model, but on steroids. And so there was always this push to get him to L.A. And that year, when he was able to be a free agent by a quirk in the NBA system, the Orlando Sentinel did a poll asking, is Shaq worth the money he's asking for, which is about $120 million. And it was a ridiculously worded poll, because nobody's worth $120 million. It's a stupid thing. Of course not. But it was a huge percentage voted no. And Shaq was really wounded, like really wounded. And that was kind of the final push he needed. And when Jerry West, you know, he made one of the great underrated trades of all time when he sent Anthony Peeler and George Lynch to Vancouver for 2 second-round picks just so he could free up money so they could sign Shaq. And when he did that, and when L.A. was able to offer the most money, and there was this chance to be a rapper, an actor, a basketball star, he just went with it. He just wanted to be bigger than Orlando.
Jeff Perlman joining us. I mean, I'll never forget that poll. It's just, it's so hard to imagine that a guy like that could be so wounded over something as significant, insignificant as that. But it really did bother him. I remember that very clearly. So what did Shaq think of Kobe initially? And what did Kobe think of Shaq initially?
That's a great question. So Kobe shows up rookie year. He plays summer league in Long Beach. And no one on this team can really stand him because he just shoots 100 times a game. And then he reports, he actually hurts his wrist. He injures his wrist before training camp playing at Venice Beach pickup, which just blows everybody's mind. Like, why is this guy playing pickup in Venice Beach? So they report to training camp in Hawaii. And on the first day, all the players are in a circle, and Dale Harris, the coach, asks everyone to introduce themselves. You know, one by one, hey, I'm Trevor Wilson. I'm Nick Van Exel. Gets to Kobe Bryant. Yo, I'm Kobe. I played at Lower Merion High School, and nobody here is going to punk me. That was his introduction to the other Lakers as an 18-year-old. Nobody here is going to punk me. It did not go over well. And early Kobe was, you know, he was not received well. It was shoot a lot of unnecessary moves, a lot of unnecessary movements. Shaq nicknamed him Showboat. You know, he just thought he was kind of a hot dog. The thing that was interesting and that definitely bothered Shaq, like, he really wanted this kid to want to be under his wing. Like, Shaq liked helping people. He liked guiding teammates. He wanted them to ask for favors, and he liked giving them. And he wanted to be Batman and Kobe Robin, or Big Brother, Little Brother. And Kobe just had zero interest in it, just none. He didn't want a Big Brother. He didn't want to be Robin. He wanted to be Batman. And it just bothered Shaq for years and years, that the nature of that relationship.
Jeff Perlman is joining us. This book is Three Ring Circus. It comes out tomorrow. All right, Jeff, again, we're covering a lot of ground, but jumping over to Phil, how did Phil Jackson fit into all this? As an example, what was the reaction when Phil said, quote, this is your team, Shaq, and Kobe, you're going to be our floor leader. You guys don't like that? Let me know now, and I'll trade you now. You're going to do what I say. If you don't, you're out of here, end quote. What about Phil, and how did he fit into all this?
Well, Kobe loved it. Shaq didn't love it. I mean, Shaq loved it. Kobe didn't love it. But, you know, when he arrived there, he came with the 6 rings from Chicago. And that was just a big deal. They'd been playing under Dale Harris and Kurt Rambis. Dale Harris just talked way too much. He's a great guy and a smart coach, but just talked a lot. And Kurt Rambis, Shaq did not enjoy playing under Kurt Rambis at all. Felt that he babied Kobe, blah, blah, blah. And here comes this guy with the six rings. And the immediate reaction was, we have to listen to him. And Shaq hears, oh, we're going to run the triangle, and I'm going to be the centerpiece of the triangle. This is fantastic. And Kobe hears, oh, we're going to run the triangle, and Shaq is going to be the centerpiece of the triangle, and I'm this kind of number two option. That's not so fantastic. But I don't really know what choice I have in this situation. So if you look at it, for many years, Kobe tried his best in the triangle. It worked. But he never really embraced the system. And toward the end of that run, he just kind of gave up on it altogether. But when he was younger and didn't have a choice, he sort of went with it as long as he could.
So, Jeff, if you had to say, who do you think enjoyed their career more, Kobe or Shaq?
Oh, it's not even close. To me, it's funny, Jim. I've thought about this a lot. Like, if you think back, there was all this criticism of Shaq, and especially from Kobe and from Kobe supporters, and I understood it, where it's like the offseason comes and Shaq is floating in a pool and he's eating a cheeseburger and he's smoking a cigar. Wow, Kobe's in the gym shooting 5,000 jumpers a day. And it was an easy criticism, right? Shaq doesn't work as hard. You're 27 years old. You're making millions and millions of dollars. You spend your season getting your butt kicked day after day after day, double teams, people slamming into you, slicing you up, and you're still averaging, whatever, 25 and 12. You shouldn't be spending your offseason in a pool eating cheeseburgers and smoking a cigar. You're only 27 and a superstar once. And I just think Shaq was in on the joke. He got that it was kind of ridiculous that they made this much money for wearing pajamas and shooting a ball through a hoop. Like, he realized how funny it was. He didn't care that Kazam sucked or that Steel sucked. Like, he enjoyed the road of it all. And I do feel like Kobe, I think he started getting it at the end when he lost some of his skills and when he got hurt and when he realized it was fleeting. But I just think during these years, he did not get the enjoyment out of it that Shaq did, not even close.
Jeff Perlman is joining us. Jeff, I got to ask you, this is a huge Mad Dog Mark Madsen house. How would you describe then the relationship between Shaq and Mark Madsen?
Oh, that guy's the best. The best.
He is the best.
I love that you love Mark Madsen.
Love him. Love him.
He's the best. All right, so the Shaq-Madsen relationship is the best relationship in the history of sports, and that's only a slight exaggeration. So first of all, I wrote a book about the Showtime Lakers, and A.C. Green, famous virgin, arrives in L.A., and the Lakers just make his life miserable. You know, like, their goal is to basically to have him have sex and corrupt him. Mark Madsen shows up, and he's this Mormon, and he did a mission in Spain, and he's really nice. And Shaq just decides, I'm going to be his Mormon matchmaker. And they'd be flying on their private jets to wherever they're going, charter flight, and there'd be a couple of flight attendants, and Shaq would be like, hey, excuse me, are you Mormon? She'd be like, no. Mark Madsen told me he would come into, like, he would show up in the Lakers front office, and maybe there'd be some women working there, and they'd be like, you're Mark Madsen? And he'd be like, yeah. And they'd be like, Shaq was in here the other day asking if any of us are Mormon, because
wow,
he wants to set us up. He was just, Shaq bought him suits, Shaq took him out for dinner, and everyone loved him. Like, Kobe Bryant was not the most generous guy with money. He just wasn't. And they had a Secret Santa one year where you couldn't spend more than $100. And he bought Mark Madsen two suits. Like, everyone loved Mark Madsen.
Jeff Perlman, of course. I mean, everybody does. Everybody still loves Mark Madsen.
Yeah.
All right. And there's another guy. And again, Jeff, I could do this for hours. There's somebody I have to ask you about. What was it like when you went to interview J.R. Ryder?
Oh, it's the best. So every now and then I knock on doors if I don't have a phone number. And it's always a little scary knocking on stranger doors. You know, you don't know what you're going to get. And I didn't have a phone number for J.R. Ryder, but I had an address. And I was in Arizona, and he lives in Arizona. And J.R. Ryder is kind of infamous in my world for sort of kind of threatening to kill two different writers, or offering the threat, I know where you live, and I know where your family lives. But I kind of wanted to talk to J.R. Ryder. So I have an address. I knock on his door.
I'm sorry, Jeff. I never, ever interrupt anybody, much less a good friend like you and somebody I respect so much. I want to make the point. That is a very bold move, by the way. That is an extremely courageous move for you just to bang on J.R. Ryder's door. I want to make that very clear.
I just like knocking. I know it's weird. It's kind of like being in really bad turbulence on a flight. There's something about the knock on the door that's kind of exciting. And I do always tell my wife where I'm going to be, though. just in case. In case I'm number three on the J.R. Ryder list. But I appreciate that. So I knock on the door. A kid answers. I'm like, hey, my name's Jeff. Is J.R. Ryder here? And he goes, hold on. A woman comes to the door. I have my U.S. of L book with me. I'm like, hey, my name's Jeff, and I'm a writer, and I'm trying to find J.R. Ryder for a book. Hold on one second. Door closes. Two people are yelling at each other behind the door, man and woman. Doesn't sound good. Door opens. There's J.R. Ryder. He's like, who are you? Hey, my name's Jeff Perlman, and I'm a writer. And he just stops me. He's like, bro, no, bro. You just drive up. He's not, no, bro, man, no, that's not. Then he opens the door, and he comes out. It's like, bro, I'm telling you, that is not cool, man. You do not just come up. What's that book you got? I'm like, oh, it's a book I wrote about the USFL. He goes, is that that's the Trump League? I'm like, yeah. He's like, what are you writing about? I'm like, well, I'm doing a book about the Shaq Kobe era, and you're on, you know, one of those teams. All right, man, I'll talk to you.
Wow.
I'll talk to you. Let me give you my number, and we'll do it over the phone. And he gave me 2 hours, and he was so nice and fantastic.
He is, right? When he is. I don't want this to be misconstrued. When I say to you it was a very bold move to knock on this guy's door, it makes it sound like this guy's a really, really bad guy. He's a legend. J.R. Ryder is one of the most fascinating guys, and he's an absolute legend on and off the floor. That's what makes that story so amazing. I mean, I wonder, what if you had brought the Cowboys book or the Brett Favre book? Or, like, why was the USFL book a source of fascination to him?
I have no – maybe because, you know, the election had happened a couple years earlier and Trump is – I don't actually know. It was funny. It's there are guys like him, like Rodman played for the Lakers during this period. I love that. I love the Cedric Ceballos stuff. I love those friends, really interesting, quirky guys like that.
Right. So finally, what about Phil Jackson? He's got a – when you talk about the media, right, he's got a pretty interesting reputation when it comes to the media. How did you go about getting time with him, and what was that experience like?
That was awesome. So Jeannie Buss has always been very nice to me, one of the Lakers. And I emailed her and I said, you know, I'm doing this book and I'm really trying to reach Phil. And she was nice. She said, well, let me email him for you. And he wrote me back and he said, when do you want to talk? And I said, can I fly out to Montana and talk to you? And he said, sure. And I flew out to Montana and I met him at a coffee shop. And the first thing I said, I was like, I just want to thank you for doing this. And he goes, I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for Jeannie. And I was like, oh, crap, this isn't going to be great. He's like, then he goes, I thought we'd take a ride around a lake, Flathead Lake. I think it's called Flathead Lake.
Yeah,
in Montana.
It is.
And he goes, and it's a huge lake. He's like, I thought I'd take you for a ride. So we start driving around this lake. Then we stop for lunch, and we continue to drive around the lake. And he's like, you want to come back to my house? I was like, sure. We go back to his house. We're sitting on a porch. There's this cat crawling around the porch, just like walking on Phil Jackson's head while I talk to him. He's great. He goes to me, yeah, I want to take a nap. You want to go get dinner later? I was like,
crazy.
Yeah. He's like, all right, meet me at 6. We'll get dinner. He could not have been nicer, more gracious, more interesting. We probably talked 40% about Lakers, 60% about life, basketball, you know, not basketball, books, travel. Just one of the most unique and interesting guys. He actually lives up to the hype as far as the zen and the interesting elements.
Jeff Perlman is a New York Times bestselling author. He has sold many, many books. The latest book, Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the Crazy Years of the Lakers Dynasty is going to come out tomorrow. I mean, shoot, Jeff, like I said, I could do that for hours, although we went pretty heavy. Great job. Can't wait for that book to drop officially, and I always appreciate the friendship and the relationship. Jeff, great job.
Thanks, Jim. Same for you. Thank you so much.
Jeff Perlman. That is good, good stuff. Really good stuff. Amazing anecdotally and some great, great, great stories from back in the day. I mean, think about the guys we're talking about. We start with a Samaki Walker story, a Club Said story, J.R. Ryder, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, Mark Madsen. So good. The dynamic between Shaq and Kobe. And as heavy as we went, as deep a dive as that was for this program, I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. There is so much more to that.